to Follow the Sound. I am your host, Brian Kroc. Each week, we explore different aspects of the world of music, including concert reviews, this week in music history, and what we are bringing you tonight, an album review. And I also want to say, if you want to help out in supporting this podcast, you can do so by going to our website at followthesoundpodcast.com and clicking on the Amazon banner on the right-hand side. You click on there, it takes you to Amazon, do all of your normal shopping, and we get a little bit of money just from everything that you purchase, and it will not cost you anything extra. So go to the website, click on the banner, or just go to followthesoundpodcast.com/Amazon. Also want to thank lineupmedia.fm for allowing us to do the show. Thanks, guys.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
Along with me on this very great episode of Follow the Sound is Greg Harvey.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
And Jacob Crum.
Wessex Sound Studios proudly presents.
Oh, that's a good little intro there.
Thank you.
I enjoyed that thoroughly. So, I'm not actually leading this album review. This one is going off to the wonderful friend that I have here, Jacob Crum, who has brought us an album that I know zero about. I've never heard it, never listened to it, and it took me a couple of times to even remember who it was, but then I was looking at the cover and stuff, and I think we got something very interesting tonight. Jake, go ahead and take it away.
All right. So today I have for you
a chime from heaven.
Pardon me. I have a brand new cell phone that apparently I don't know how to mute.
I always thought it was funny that back in when I first started in radio, somebody was actually saying, it's like, you never reveal behind the curtain, like what's actually going on. It's like, you never do that. I was like, why? It's like, that's funny. Let's do it. So there you go. Jake, please continue and enlighten us on what you've brought us today.
All right. So what I've brought today is an album that I've talked about a lot.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm always the only person at the table that knows anything about them.
That is true.
I have today King Crimson's In the Court of the Crimson King, their debut album, the quintessential album, the album that changed pop music. Even though you've never heard it.
Hmm. Interesting.
So this album.
I am intrigued.
Yes. And you get to listen to this just like everyone did in 1969 when it came out.
I do like that.
Because there was no lead up to this band. So let's answer. We're going to answer three questions with this show, which is, what is King Crimson? Who is King Crimson? And why are they important?
And why King Crimson? I like it. Okay. So initial thoughts.
Yes.
I'm holding the CD in my hand here.
Very artistic.
Very artistic. You know, it's funny. I wasn't even going to comment on the actual artwork,
mm-hmm.
But I guess I can. So when I open up the liner notes here, there's actually a photograph of the young man who designed the album cover. It says Barry Godber.
Mm-hmm.
Great.
Okay.
Yeah. And it says, with the record sleeve he designed, and a photo of that. Very trippy, psychedelic photos on there, but I won't really... go into that too much, but I will say though, I really like that this CD case is designed exactly like a record sleeve, just
yeah.
in miniature form, because it's cardboard and it's got the when you can open it mm-hmm. up like a book, and on the left side you open up and there's the liner notes, and on the right side the CD comes in a like a paper sleeve like a record would,
yeah.
and I don't know why, but that's cool.
Now, I lost it, but, okay, when you used to buy records, the packaging company would put an insert in with the album sleeve,
mm-hmm.
right? So sometimes you'd open it up, and it would look like a newspaper print with, like, little classified ads on
yeah.
it. That came with a sheet that looked like that.
Cool.
And it might have been a sheet from 1969, or it could have been some bullshit they made up. I really don't know, but it tore when I opened it, and just kept getting worse the more I listened to the album. And this disc is pretty scratched. So, all right, first off, I finally found my CD, guys.
Yay!
It took me a year to find the damn thing.
I'm not kidding. When he messaged me and was just like, oh my God, I found my CD.
Yeah. I think you had an album planned for this review and
yes.
everything.
Yes.
And then you were like, forget it. Forget everything. I found it. We're doing King Crimson.
Right. Because, all right, so I have a problem with all the MP3 versions of it that you can buy online. they sound terrible.
Really?
The compression on it, yes, the compression on the MP3s really makes the opening of the very first track sound like garbage.
Mm.
It complete whatever for whatever reason, just the way the numbers get crunched,
mm-hmm.
it completely changes the timbre of the distortion on the organ.
Well, there is a most people probably don't know this because MP3 is not a lossless
yes.
Format. I mean, if you want to get true audio quality, you got to go with a WAV file at least. But even then, CDs and WAV files are all cut off at the 20,000 mark. But vinyl albums aren't. And vinyl albums actually go up to generally between, they're still getting signal in like the 90,000 mm-hmm. range, which is why people say that vinyl sounds better. And really what it is just that all of this extra range that was on there is still in existence, even though our human ears can't actually hear it.
Fair
so
enough.
There you go. There's your little lesson in audio quality.
Which, in retrospect, I know that when we compress and upload this, it's going to do either the exact same thing or something similar. So it's kind of pointless, but it's so hard for me to sit and listen
yeah, but,
to it.
Yeah, you know, who cares about those
know,
people?
Right?
It's about our review.
Exactly.
So.
And in mono. You
listeners,
know, we upload in mono.
We do appreciate you. So.
Anyhow.
Well.
Okay, so our first question, what is King Crimson? King Crimson, superficially, is a band. But if you ask Robert Fripp, the leader of that band, he says King Crimson is a way of doing things, which sounds like he's being really haughty and has we're something more than a band. It's not that. It's just that when you go to a King Crimson show, regardless of who's in the lineup, don't expect them to play the hits because they're not going to do that. They're going to play the new music and what they want to do on stage that day.
That's bullshit. I'm never going to see this band.
Never.
Honestly, if I went and saw a band for the first time and they didn't play any hits, I would be pretty disappointed.
Yeah.
Genuinely. Well, going to concerts is a treat for some people. And my favorite band I've only seen once.
Yeah.
And I probably will only ever see once because it's just too expensive. So.
But their lineup. Sometimes they don't have a bass player. Sometimes they have a shtick player. Sometimes they don't have a stick player.
Also kind of weird, but like mm-hmm. if you were a big fan, that would be unique
yes.
and that would be a treat.
So if you look up the stick instrument, you will see the very first like 10 photos you will see is Tony Levin, who is the stick player for King Crimson.
Playing the stick.
Yeah. That guy and that instrument are inseparable.
Think of all the things you could do with a stick. Not only could you whack it on things, but you could like break it in half and get that crunching sound too.
Yeah. Or you can, thump on it and sound like a slap bass, or you can strum on it, or you can use the built-in e-bow and
a stick?
Yes. You're not familiar with a stick?
I guess not.
Oh, okay, so a stick.
Oh, is this like a broom handle with a string?
A stick is like a 12-string bass that covers all the way from the low end of a low B string to the high E on a guitar.
Oh.
And it has a built-in e-bow, so when you just press your finger to the fret, you have sound.
Wow. I recognize the instrument. We have it pulled up on the screen here. Yeah, I've seen that
it
before.
It is literally like a bass guitar and like a regular guitar fused together, where all the strings just go in sequence.
Yes.
I thought we were talking about a literal stick.
No, sorry, Greg.
But you could still break that in half.
Yeah. But you're not going to hear a stick on this because this album is 20 years before its invention. So,
okay.
So who is King Crimson
who
and what
King
version
Crimson?
Of King Crimson are we listening to?
Yes.
So King Crimson
answer that question
is
now.
Robert Fripp. He's the only constant member. He is a guitar player, classically trained, from somewhere in England. I really don't care where he's from. The point is that earlier in 1966 or so, he met the Giles brothers, Michael and Peter Giles. They formed a band. They tried to get a singer. They couldn't get a singer, so they made just instrumental music. Their highest point of fame was when Keith Moon made fun of them in Rolling Stones. And then they got a little bit of radio play, and then Peter Giles quit. Greg Lake joined. Greg Lake from Emerson, Lake & Palmer. And they formed this version of King Crimson right here that you're going to hear.
Just to let you know, Fripp is from Dorset, England.
Wow. That's the fact of the show.
So we've got Robert Fripp, Greg Lake singing and playing bass, Michael Giles playing guitar, Ian McDonald, and Peter Sinfield, who Sinfield is their organist and their art director.
It says here that Peter Sinfield is credited as words and illumination.
There you go. Thank you.
That's awesome.
Mm-hmm. Oh, by the way, Barry Godbetter.
I believe, I don't know, but it's G-O-D, God, God, B-E-R, Burr.
Okay, God, Burr. All right. Either way, he was like a computer programmer, wasn't really an artist. So.
Well, that's pretty good artwork.
This is the only album cover he ever did because he died like shortly after this was released.
Yeah, it looked like he was doing some drugs too.
Yeah, probably.
Looking at the picture of the dude, it looks like he does drugs.
So they got a record contract. They put out this album. And nobody was expecting anything because nobody knew who anyone was. But as they made their rounds, that is a total nerd and a druggie.
The dude with the beard?
Yes. So, Rappaport tells a story about how he met Jimi Hendrix in 1969. And Jimi Hendrix came to see them in concert and went backstage. And he was dressed all in white. And he had his right arm in a sling, in a white sling. He said he was the most luminous person he's ever seen. And Jimi Hendrix walked up to him and he said, "Hey, shake my left hand because it's the closest to my heart." And he shook his hand and met him and they talked and that was all great. And then 20 years later, he ran into Michael Giles' sister who was at that show.
Mm-hmm.
And she said, "Hey, you remember that show that Jimi Hendrix came to?" He's like, yeah, I tell that story all the time. She's like, "Well, there's an addendum to that story because I don't think I ever talked to you about this, but I was sitting at the table next to him." And... The ushers for the venue, it was a sit-down venue with tables and such, mm-hmm. kept coming back and telling him to sit down because the entire show he was standing up yelling as loud as he could because he couldn't clap his hands and saying, like, "This is the best thing I've ever heard. This is the best band in the world. And this is the first song Jimi Hendrix heard from them. It's the first song on the track. It's called 21st Century Schizoid Man." We'll be right back.
That is trippy.
Yeah?
Yeah. I dig that.
Yeah.
So I want you to imagine that it's 1969 and that you just watched, like, I don't know, four or five people who are trying to be some version of The Who, The Beatles, Sgt. Pepper, and The Animals get on stage. And then you break into 21st Century Schizoid Man with Greg Lake singing in distorted vocals. And then a what sounds like a spontaneous jazz improv in the middle of it.
Yep. I loved it. That bass was just so good.
Yeah, so that was definitely ripping and super psychedelic, exactly what you would expect from this. Mm-hmm. I didn't know what to expect, but it sounds exactly like what I kind of would have predicted from the artwork and from the time period and whatnot. Really tight, really good. I mean, reminiscent of all those other bands, you know, and like Frank Zappa and stuff too in there. Just very spacey, yet they keep it tight. So we were talking off the mic as well, too, that this track is how long?
7 minutes and 24 seconds.
Okay. Yeah, so we're only hearing the introduction to the song, yeah, essentially. Yeah. We can't legally play more, but that's really cool. First impression was a good one.
I dig it. All right, so
yes,
they've now established themselves as this interesting fusion of rock and jazz and other stuff. They're out on stage. They've played in front of Hendrix. Hendrix thinks that they're the greatest band ever.
Yes.
So what are we moving on to next?
Well, and this is an interesting thing that I want to point out. At the time, Greg Lake was a pretty heavy driving force in the band, even though this is the only album he did with them. So one of his big things was that the set list and the album should be the same, which I don't know any other group that's always done that.
I love it when a band comes out and plays like the album.
Mm-hmm.
I always think that's really cool, and I've honestly only seen it done twice.
Yeah.
And that was Ludo, when they came out and did Broken Bride, like, in its entirety, and that was amazing, and U2 with the Joshua Tree. So,
yeah.
Yeah, I've only ever seen that done when bands were, like, purposefully, mm-hmm. you know, where they're like, hey, you know, we're doing this tour and we're going to play this album in its entirety. And it's like, yeah, you know that going into it. But it's different when the band gets up there and it's like, you hear exactly what you heard on the album.
Yeah.
But not, you know, not prefacing it to begin with. Because, I mean, it's different if you're like, oh, it's the 25th anniversary. We're going to play from, mm-hmm. you know, cover to cover. It's like, okay, cool.
Like, groups that I pop to mind when I think they're known for doing that, it's kind of like Pink Floyd, ELO. I've heard of people who said they went to a Yes concert and they played like an entire album. So,
you know, if you see Pink Floyd, they kind of have to, in a way. You know, I mean, like, those songs all flow together so well.
Yeah.
But something tells me this album is probably similar to that. Am I wrong or am I right?
Maybe. We'll get to it. The next track is called Talk to the Wind. And it's probably the most radio of all the tracks on this.
Set the straight man to the late man. Where have you been? I've been here and I've been there and I've been in between. I talk to the wind. My words are all carried away. I talk to the wind. Outside. talk to the wind. My words are all carried away. I talk to the wind. The wind does not hear. The wind cannot hear.
Well, as songs about the wind goes, I mean, that's got to be like at least number two for me.
All right.
The first one being...
Akeboshi?
No. The Wind by Cat Stevens.
Okay.
Although you did remind me, Wind by Akeboshi.
That's what I thought you were going to say.
No, that's pretty good too.
If I had...
I'd love to do an Akeboshi review. Although, I'm going to have to mark that one down.
I don't know. I think that song is still wind, like winding a clock.
Oh, I mean, I guess. Wind. Yeah, I don't know.
It does, whatever.
Either way.
Yeah.
That was really nice. The thing that I actually liked about it is that it almost sounded like it was a Nick Drake track, except it had a lot more instruments to it, and Nick Drake like would have just been acoustic and singing. But yeah, that was nice. I understand what you were talking about as far as like it being the most radio song. I've actually heard this one before.
Yeah.
Because it showed up in a movie once, and I was like, huh, that's a nice little song.
It is. Now, I want you to remember, going back to King Crimson as a way of doing things.
Yes.
If you don't have two woodwind players in your band, you can't play that song.
Yeah.
If you don't have an oboe and a fife, you can't play that song. You just can't. Because it's the entire melody for the first 3 minutes of it.
That song to me, oh gosh, it's a different time. Because I want to say that's like a quintessential, like you could sum up the year in rock with that kind of song. Because it just sounds like so many other things. Like you were mentioning the influences like with the Beatles and stuff. Yeah. It sounds like that. And I would say that it was cliche if it wasn't for the fact that this is original, because in 69 they would have been pioneering it, and in hindsight it just sounds cliche.
Maybe. I mean, as far as the way he's singing, the melody that he's singing,
like the harmony
certainly does,
and like the round the rounded edges of it with the woodwind instruments that kind of mellow it out.
The thing that I think is interesting is that this, again, you kind of see the jazz influence on this, because this is a suspended chord where you have, they're playing a chord above and the chord below. So it's not just an A, it's like G and A. So you're hearing the other instruments kind of dance around the woodwinds. And you have that like triple downstep across three measures that they're doing. That is a lot more interesting than just the vocal arrangement. That's what I appreciate about King Crimson, is that, you take a Beatles song like Don't Bring Me Down, okay, which has a very similar chord shape and pattern to this, Don't Bring Me Down, right? And the same thing, I talk to the wind, right?
Mm-hmm.
But they don't have that weirdness of the dissonance when they get to the fourth bar in a measure where there's a dissonance between what the bass is playing and where the woodwinds are at. And then it resolves two measures later. I'm talking too much. I'm gushing.
No, it's cool. It's just, I mean, this is certainly like a psychedelic rock, which that's quintessential, is to kind of throw you off a little bit in a way. Like that's what kind of, for me at least, that's what makes the psychedelic sound work, is that there's a lot of kind of note bending, and you kind of don't let things feel natural until maybe a few measures after you would like to feel that natural conclusion. And so you still get the gratification from it, but you also kind of have it gives you a weird kind of feeling. I like it.
I love it.
I like that weird feeling.
Just to let you know, Wikipedia lists King Crimson as progressive rock, art rock, post-progressive, and proto-progressive.
Proto-progressive. Love it.
So here's what I love about it. Progressive rock. We all know what that is. It's prog rock, you know. It's all that. Art rock, I know what that is. But then you get into post-progressive and then proto-progressive, which means They've literally covered all three of the progressive stages. Before, during, and after. Good on you, King Crimson. That is an accomplishment.
So if that doesn't kind of show you where Robert Fripp fits in the music world, then here's another weird little fact. Because the next two songs have a lot of soundscape in them.
All right.
Because, okay, Epitaph is almost 9 minutes and Moonchild is 12 minutes.
Yup.
So a lot of soundscape. Brian Eno's first album, 1974.
Oh, yeah?
Robert Fripp played on it.
Oh, nice.
And was kind of, should have had a producer's nod. Like, should have maybe what? But who cares?
Mm-hmm.
I don't think he cares. He was on Brian Eno's album.
Mm-hmm.
Anyway, let's just go on to the next song. This is Epitaph. Yes.
That one, I kind of wish that I could keep going on that one to see where it ends up, because it seemed like it was going somewhere cool, but we can only play so much of the song before we get in trouble.
So I'm the naive one here, I think. So that's Greg Lake doing all the lead vocals? Okay.
I think he's doing all the vocals. They might have brought in a session artist or somebody else to do some of the harmonies.
Okay. Well, the credits here, for the most part, I believe it looks like it says Greg Lake is lead vocals, and then Ian McDonald does vocals, and Michael Gills does vocals. But I was just curious because Greg Lake is probably one of the most famous people on this album, of course, along with Robert Fripp. But I recognize his voice, you know, that quintessential sound that goes with this. And I think that's what kind of makes it, because I've never heard this before, but it also sounds very familiar. Wouldn't you agree, Brian?
Agreed.
It's just that familiar
it does,
sound.
Yes, it has. It has that tone to it that has kind of become part of, you know, prog rock. And, you know, but they were obviously like pioneers of it.
Yeah. Yeah.
It's just that other people, you know, adopted those sounds as well. And
well,
so.
And that's what I was getting at, was like, I almost feel like maybe I'm, you know, doing them a disservice or something, because, you know, I'm sitting here saying, wow, this sounds so 60s, you know, it sounds so like, you know, that time period and stuff. And it's like, well, yeah, because that's where they're from. And,
well, it's no, I don't think you're doing them a disservice, because that's part of the reason that Greg Lake left King Crimson, was because everything that you hear in this that sounds like, oh, well, it fits in there, was because of Greg Lake's influence. He was sort of the pop music drive in the band, and once he left, everything was kind of off the rails.
Okay. So he kept it like almost playable on the radio.
Right, right. That, and they signed, I think, to the same studio at, I think they signed to EMI, which is the same studio as Pink Floyd. Was that, because they had a, they put out their first record either in 67 or 68. So, and I think it sold well, the first one did. So, I don't know that, I don't think they toured together, but maybe the label was like, hey, maybe this is, you know, our shtick. Maybe this is what we can push.
Okay.
And yeah, it's, boy, it is kind of weird to hear Greg Lake's voice for the first time without Keith Emerson's, you know, seven synthesizers over the top of it.
Yeah, yeah. Well, and that's what makes it so familiar, is because I've heard Greg Lake's voice a million times before. So back to this song in particular, something interesting I noticed was that I think the most pronounced part of the song was the drums. To me, that snare drum...
Yeah, they, it really cuts through
the
sound.
That snare drum cut through everything, and it sounded like it was the loudest track for that snare, because it was so clear. I mean, as a drummer, it sounds like it was right next to my head, and somebody was hitting it. Whereas everything else is so dissonant, and like it seems like it's, you know, off in the background. Almost like I'm standing next to the drummer, watching the band play on the other side of the room.
Yeah.
You know?
Well, this track is actually split into two movements. So it's the first movement is March for No Reason. So maybe that's why the snare is that high in the mix.
That,
because,
that would make sense.
Yeah, he's kind of doing that semi-march beat, because it breaks up and then, like, it's not just a straight march on a snare. Anyway.
No, that's very cool. Wow, that's interesting. We don't even make it to the second movement.
I know.
Yeah.
This song's going to completely change.
I know.
And listen to it for several minutes, and we still didn't get there.
The next song, Moonchild, is 12 minutes and something.
Yes.
And the last time they played it live, it was almost 20 minutes and had another movement. So, like, there's more to this song than I even get to listen to owning it.
Yeah, it says here, Moonchild, including The Dream and The Illusion. Yeah,
I want to say the third movement's called The Child. I'm not sure. I'm not sure.
So you want to get to it?
Yes, let's get to Moonchild. You know, I don't even know how this one starts. I can't remember.
Well, let's find out together.
We could listen to a minute of soundscape, and I kind of hope we do. Let's hear
All right, here we go.
Lonely moon child, dreaming in the the ghosts of dawn, waiting for a smile from a sun
All right, Jake, I'm sure that that was going to build to some some great thing. Figured I'd fade it out right there.
I do like the vibraphone going.
Oh, yeah, you got to love the vibraphone.
For that little dissonant part. Yeah.
I got to admit, it's a little bothersome with headphones on.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah, for me, it kind of hurt my ears. Not gonna lie.
Well, on vinyl, this would sound really good. Probably. If you were sitting on your couch or something listening to it, Yeah, I mean, when you have a blast in your ears, yeah, it's a little different. That one kind of reminded me of Stairway to Heaven.
Okay.
With the lyrics along with the feel. Because, it's the woodwinds, man. It's just kind of that light, like the intro to Stairway to Heaven is what this song sounded like. You know, like the first 30 seconds or the first minute of Stairway to Heaven. Mm-hmm. Very similar. I also like, too, the percussion once again. I think the percussion is really what helps kind of distinguish a lot of this music.
I like that it was muted.
Well, yeah,
the drums
were
muted.
I thought he was playing with mallets, is what I imagined.
I honestly think he just had, towels over the drums.
Yeah.
Because that's what it sounded like to me.
Yeah, yeah. Same concept as having the cloth on the, you know, and not the direct stick to skin, if you will. That was a good one. Kind of trippy.
There are so many different lineups and so many different albums from King Crimson. I really want to bring in a Bill Buford album. He's a really weird kind of experimental percussionist. And Lark's Tongue and Aspics is a really strange exploration in how melodic can you get with percussion. And I think you'd really like that. But we're still doing it in the Court of the Crimson King, so.
Yeah. Is now maybe an okay time for me to take a moment here and just elaborate on these liner notes?
Sure.
Go for it.
So something really interesting about these liner notes, besides all the great pictures and stuff, is that most of it is actually just newspaper clippings of reviews of the album itself. And some of them are kind of comical. I wanted to read you at least one or two of them here. So this one is from The Disc. On October 25th, 1969, they say, King Crimson in the Court of the Crimson King from Island Records. First LP from the group heralded by those who know to be the most exciting discovery of the year. Get over the most horrific album cover of the year, and you'll find the pundits are not wrong. They go on to say, a brilliant mixture of melody and freak out, fast and slow, atmospheric and electric, all heightened by the words of Peter Sinfield. I like that they mention, though, just get past the disturbing album cover and you'll find that it's pretty good. And just one other one I wanted to mention. This one was from the New Musical Express, October 18th, 1969. It says, King Crimson at last. Long-awaited first album from the remarkable King Crimson, a group which manages to provoke either loathing or fanatical devotion, but which is undoubtedly capable of building for itself a sizable reputation. And I think that these reviews are pretty spot on, and they say it better than I could. So.
Fair enough.
But I definitely like them being like, I don't know what's up with the album cover, but it's a good album. And I definitely liked that part where they said here, you either love it or hate it. You either really love it or you really hate it. And I don't know if there's really any in between here.
I mean, I can't see how you listen to this and not just be ecstatic and overwhelmed by the
just euphoric.
Yeah, I don't understand how you can have a lukewarm response or a negative response from any of this. Like Moonchild does go a little bit off the rails and it's 12 minutes long. So if you're 10 years old and you don't have the attention span to listen to it.
Well, I think
I understand.
The point is yeah, when you have 9 minute, 12 minute songs, stuff like that, you either do like it or you don't, because you're not sitting through 12 minutes if you're not enjoying it. Simply put.
Fair enough.
All right.
All right.
So we got one more.
We've got one more. It's called it's called The Court of the Crimson King. And it's what it is.
All right, then let's give it a listen.
It's this whole album.
Shattered by the sun, I walk a road, horizons change, the tournament's begun. The purple piper plays his tune, the choir softly sing. Three lullabies in an ancient tongue for the court of the crimson. Shutters on the dreams, I wait outside the pilgrim's door with insufficient schemes. The Black Queen chants the funeral march, the cracked brass bells will ring to summon back the fire witch to the court of the crimson.
I liked that one quite a bit, actually. I loved how it randomly went to that faster bit, you know, just yeah. A dun, 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 dun. Like, I don't know. Like, this is the kind of song that would be very good, I think, if it had an animation to go with it.
Okay. Yeah, like, this should be the second half of the next heavy metal.
Like, the Lord of the Rings, like, animated film.
like the rotoscope stuff.
Yeah, that'd be awesome. Somebody should have done that.
This definitely has like an acid trip, like cartoon associated with it.
Oh yeah,
with somewhere.
Yeah, with the
or an LSD cartoon.
The rolls on the snare and the choir, like,
well, yeah,
that, ushering you back to sobriety.
It's so crazy because like this just is so like Sgt. Pepper's Lonely Hearts Club Band meets Pink Floyd meets everything else from that genre. Like I kept expecting it to go into what's the Beatles song? What am I thinking of?
I have no idea, and I'm usually pretty good at spotting these things.
Isn't it? Woke up, got out of bed, dragged a comb across my head. Yeah, and then it goes into that part where it gets really spaced out. Come on, you guys. You know exactly.
I know the first part that you were singing. I don't know the second part. I'm sorry.
Okay. Well, anyways.
This makes for great podcasts, too. So yeah, I just want to point that out.
What is Greg talking
about? What's Greg talking about? If anyone knows, please contact us on Facebook. You can find us on Facebook at the Follow the Sound group.
Well, you see, you guys, you take a squirrel and you take a potato, okay?
Or you can find us on Twitter at IFollowTheSound. Please get in contact with us if you know what Greg is humming. This should be a weekly thing.
Mail me a fresh avocado. Speaking of acid trips, Jesus. No, this is good. Like, this was probably one of my favorite tracks off the album, just from the little bit we were able to hear. But what was it with the late 60s and, like, the fantasy lyrics? Like, it's not just a rock song that's like, you know, like the same exact song, except like, ooh, baby, gonna rock you tonight. Instead, it's like, you know, we saw the Wizard King and he gave us, you know, the key. And
I don't know, but all of those bands that were doing that came out of England.
That's in very true, yeah.
I mean, every single one of them. You think of...
And Lord of the Rings was quite popular.
Yeah,
well, that's true.
I mean, maybe it was just a pop culture thing.
But then that kind of got dropped in that form of rock and then got picked up in the, you know, heavy metal, hard rock genres.
Well, that's true.
With like,
because like Iron Maiden
and Dio.
Yeah, yeah. Because that's it is like they're the harder version of that stuff. Huh. That's an interesting.
I mean, nobody,
point.
Nobody could tell me that Dio wasn't like fantasy rock.
Oh yeah.
You know, that's a great point. I think that there might be a bit of a culture gap here as far as English culture being really into it at the time. And then me just not understanding it?
Maybe. I mean, I can't tell you why. I can't look at when I say...
Tell me, Jake.
Well, obviously, if you look at the political climate that was in the, you know, with the upcoming, the rising of the IRA and domestic terrorism, of course people would look to a fantasy outlet to allow their minds to escape the tortures of the day. This is
the best bit Jake has ever done.
BBC Radio.
BBC Radio explanation of the rise of fantasy prog rock.
I feel like
in relation to the IRA.
If Alice in Wonderland.
Brilliant.
If Alice in Wonderland was an album, I think this would be it. You know?
Well, no, you know what? Actually, I am going to say this. Have you ever thought of what the impact of the moon landing was on the rest of the world? Okay, let's look at the UK, right, and the mindset that was going on. So the UK had just come out of World War II, went through the greatest depression economically that they had faced in a long time, watched the breakup of the kingdom, right, of the British Empire, with just handing back pieces of Africa and the Middle East and all these little islands back. Just here you go. You take care of yourself. You take care of yourself. Use it. Break up the empire. Break up the empire. Break up the empire, right? And then some other country accomplishes the greatest feat mankind has ever done.
Allegedly.
Allegedly, right. So you're watching literally everyone else just have, you know, great financial achievements while your empire is breaking up. Of course you're going to escape to fantasy.
Well, and
of course you're going to be, you know what, let's go back to a prehistory time before we could write down our failings and the trappings that led us to this downfall.
Yeah. Lords and serfs and...
Yeah.
Warlocks. Mm-hmm. Huh. Wow. Well,
yeah, the moon landing happened well before this album came out, so makes sense.
Well before, like, a few months, though,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, a few months, yes.
Hmm. Wow. Well,
this was released in October. We landed on the moon in July.
Okay.
Yeah, that's my theory, anyway, that I came up with just now.
Well, so the album as a whole, we've reached that point, the end of the show. Gosh, I think it lives up to my expectations and exceeds them.
Did I talk it up enough?
Considering that I came into this basically like with no preconceived notions about what it was going to be. I mean, I honestly had no clue about this album, about the band or anything. And so it could have literally been in any genre.
And instead, it's in every genre.
So I rather enjoyed it. Now, as you know, I'm not a huge prog rock guy. I'm not that big into Pink Floyd. I'm not that big into any of the other groups that popped up at the same time. And so that's you know, it's just my musical bias. I'm just really not that into it. That first song is amazing, actually. That first song was killer. The rest of it sort of fell into that same kind of flow that a lot of the other prog rock groups that I've heard, you know, got into. You know, so if I'm going to rank this, I'm probably going to give it like, I don't know, like a 6 out of 10. It's a good album for me. But it's not like it's not going to be my favorite album. But like I said, that's my bias purely against prog rock bands. So,
Okay.
Greg, what you got?
Wow. Well, I'm trying to give these guys the benefit of the doubt because, like I said,
I would like to listen to more of the band and see what their later stuff is like and see, you know, if how more complex it is and less influenced by Lake. You know, I'd like to see what they were after that fact.
Yeah.
So.
Well, yeah, I want to give these guys the benefit of the doubt because they were doing this right when this was the thing to do. And yet it wasn't. But with that being said, I think that's going to raise my score a little bit because it was so fresh and new for the time. So I'll go ahead and give it a 7 because I think a six would be my feeling about it. But I think for the people who are hearing this for the first time, it should be a 7. It probably was a 7 for them. It was probably higher than a 7, honestly, for them. So the musicianship, top notch, spot on. Reading about Fripp's endeavors into just musical technology and concepts too. I will lend him a little more credit for that as well, because the soundscapes, as we were saying, his use of the loop pedals, loop effects, digital effects when they came out, whatever was the new technology, he embraced it and he revolutionized it. And the fact that this is an album that in some instances, this is the first time we're hearing some of these concepts that to us are old and played out, but he pioneered them, and he clearly did that on this album. So I think a 7 is definitely a solid bet with all those reasons.
All right. I respect both of those opinions. Okay, so all that being said, I think that this is King Crimson's like third best album.
Hmm.
But I wanted to bring this one in because it's something everyone talks about, and it's not a sleeper by any means. It's still a good album.
Yeah.
The other two albums being Lark's Tongues and Aspic, which is like every drummer should listen to, because if you ever thought, why aren't the drums in the mix? Go listen to Lark's Tongues and Aspic and you'll feel better. And the other one is Discipline. And I don't know if I'll ever do a review of Discipline because it's crazy. the guitar player is Andrew Bellew, and there's one song where he doesn't do anything on his guitar other than make seagulls noises. Like, it sounds like birds. Sounds exactly like seagulls.
I can do that. No, I can't. It's easier said than done.
Yeah. It's discipline is really out there. Maybe we'll get around to it. Who knows? So my opinion of In the Court of the Crimson King on its own merits, it's a 10 out of a 10 for me. I love this album. I wish we kind of could have just hit play and then just let it go and come back at the end of it. Every song kind of goes somewhere. It always surprises me, even when I can audiate some of these songs in my head. Right? Yeah. Like, I can start In the Court of the Crimson King when I'm taking a shower and go through the entire song in my head all the way to the end. And when I listen to it, it still hits me every time. So there you go.
Well, one of the reviews in here said that this album was lacking a lot of the energy they bring for the live shows. So if that's the
case... None of that came from Robert Fripp, though, because he plays sitting down.
Well, there's some photos here. He's standing up
in
the photo.
Those were very early on, probably, because he and Greg Lake argued back and forth for a very long time. He's like, look, I can't play standing up. I'm a classical guitar player. I sit playing down. And he said, you can't sit playing down. You look like a mushroom on stage. And he said, well, you know, in a lot of cultures, mushrooms are considered a symbol of fertility, so...
Wow. You got an answer for everything, don't
Eventually,
you?
He got his own stool. The their label went out and bought a stool and painted the entire stool black so it would disappear on stage, because apparently seeing just a chair on stage was depressing to people. See, I don't know. His guitar playing is so subtle and energetic. It's everything it wants to be when it wants to be it. And He's a guitar god. He has his own tuning, right? Called new standard tuning, where he's tuned in fifths instead of in fourths, so like a cello.
Interesting.
He does not on this album. He didn't start doing that till the 80s. But Robert Fripp is a guitar god, and I love this album.
It did say that, like, every single list of greatest guitarists of all time, he makes the list. Like, they said Guitar World's, like, 50 greatest, and he was, like, number 47. So for a guy that I haven't
never heard of.
Yeah, I had really never heard of before today, I'm convinced that, he probably does deserve to be on those lists. And honestly, those people know better than I do anyways.
It's funny. He'll pop up in all kinds of things. Like, he played on a couple of Blondie albums.
Really?
Yeah.
Of course he did.
Of course.
Well, you know, but Blondie rips. I mean, they on it for who they are, they kick butt too, so he probably was a good fit there. So great.
Well,
I enjoyed this.
I did enjoy this. I know I kind of gave it a lower score than I have on other albums, but that didn't stop the fact that I enjoyed listening to it.
Fair enough.
And I loved hearing your stories about it. So that's why I love doing the show in the first place. Is that I love hearing about what other people think about their favorite music. And I love hearing their stories about why they love it. And that's what you did. And so I'm happy that you did that for me, because that makes me feel good. And especially, you know, it's always good to see somebody's face light up when they talk about something that they love. So.
Especially Jake.
Especially Aww. Jake. In all of his orneriness and just a sour looking face that he has.
I like the sour face he gives you when you say that. Like, that what? True. I don't have a sour
face. For those of you who don't know, Jake's beard is glorious, and he has long flowing hair as well.
Magnificent is the word you're looking
yes.
for.
Yes. Magnificent is a much better word for that.
I was talking to Jake earlier today, and he just had like a towel draped over his shoulders because he was letting his beautiful hair dry. Something I have never experienced in my life. To have to wait for your hair to dry? That's crazy.
I've had longer hair, as you guys have seen before, but it's never been as long as his. And this is nowhere near the longest his hair has been.
You know, that's actually true. You would have fit in very well into these liner notes.
You would have fit in very
well notes.
In this band. Yeah. So there you go. Yeah. Jake is just, he missed out on the prog rock, like big era, you know, so he just, he's trying to make up for it.
All right, here's the thing. It's not like I have to have the towel, okay? It's just that there are certain things in life I hate doing. because I feel like I'm wasting my time doing them. For some people, that's sitting at a red light. For others, it might be waiting in line at the bank to like make change so that they can go put change in a meter or whatever. For me, it's blow dryers. I feel my hair's going to dry anyway. Why should I waste my time actively doing it?
Well, I get it. Anyway,
I could list the merits of using a blow dryer, but we'll save that for the next
fair
one.
Enough.
All right, folks. This has been another great episode of Follow the Sound. Of course, if you liked listening to the clips of the album we played, go out and buy it, because you know what? That's what you need to do. Like, go out and purchase the music that you enjoy. Give those artists some money and show your support for any of the musicians that are out there and pay them their due. I have been your host, Brian Kroc. And along with me, of course, has been Greg Harvey.
21st century schizoid man.
And Jacob Crum.
Considering the existential crisis of today's youth and the abandonment of the caste system.
Remember, if you hear it, follow the sound.
This podcast was a presentation of lineupmedia.fm.